So today's the it's the day after Freedom Day. It is. So how do we attain the day after Freedom Day? So yesterday we looked at Freedom Day and played with the word freedom. How is it in this practice? How do we see freedom? And we looked at how in our practice freedom means waking up in whatever situation we find ourselves, however we find ourselves, whoever we find ourselves to be and to be with. Not dependent on political circumstance, social circumstance, health, age, sex, learning, temperament. That freedom in the Zen sense means being with what is, deeply accepting of the fact of our situation. And from there, we respond to the pains of the world because we feel them intimately. From there, we can act our lives out in social and political dimensions. But the fundamental freedom is not one that depends on any circumstance. So, today we're continuing to look, sorry to say, at the 10th precept, just because that's the context of this retreat, and we've been going for a month now. And some of the things you will have heard before and some not. Looking at precept as koan. Often in Zen manuals, you'll see things requiring you to have a particular kind of experience in order to study Zen. You have to have turned around in the seat of your consciousness. You've had to be blown apart. You have to have had a mystical experience of some kind. It's not limited to Zen, of course, or Buddhism. There are, in almost every religious tradition, the kind of Baptist, Pauline emphases in Christianity, early Quakers, Hasidic mystics, Sufi dervishes. The list is endless. It's a common feature of religious traditions that a certain kind of experience is required to be part of that group. And certainly, as I say, in some of the Japanese writings and some of the schools in practice, you hear it, you can't study Zen unless you've had a particular kind of experience. And some people do have very profound experiences, as we know. That's where their life has led them, often with great suffering, illness, struggle, striving, conflict that precedes it, and then some breaking open. And it may well be that people who have that kind of experience have a particular role to play by virtue of that. But I think it would be demeaning our Zen practice if we were to say it was limited to an elite few spiritual athletes. Okay. I think that would be underestimating the profundity and depth of this practice. Just as freedom is being with whatever is, whatever it may be, so we practice in our life wherever we find ourselves and with whatever experiences we have, whatever they may be. And in that sense, let's use the word enlightenment. It's the sort of bogey in the shop in Buddhism. Enlightenment is not just an experience for the few. It's that's a particular idea. Let's loosen that idea. Let's throw it away completely and say, even if we'd still use the word, because it may be useful, that enlightenment is being deeply with whatever is. Just this is it, as Jung means. Just this is it. And if we pay attention to our experience, we see that all of us have a pattern of struggle in our lives, of dismay and conflict and regret and remorse and a sense of alienation, a sense of isolation and loneliness and unworthiness. All of us have that in some measure. And all of us know in some measure the release from that. Little moments where the pain is just dissolved. With no merit of our own, and always in a surprising and startling way. But all of us know sudden moments of kindness, generosity, forgiveness, of relief, spaciousness, of beauty, all of those words that we associate with that kind of experience. And they're not always melodramatic, operatic openings. Okay. I mean, it's a great idea. Topsy is always but sometimes we find the Topsy in someone handing us a bowl. someone allowing us to walk ahead. Child's smile. We find it in littered in our lives, everywhere. And once we begin this practice and we begin to look maybe more attentively, we find it appearing all over the place, unexpectedly. It's like a magic show. Under the armpits. Bah! Grab it. Bah! Okay. And it always has a magical dissolving quality, resolving quality about it. So that's one thing I want to say about our Zen practice here, Poplar Grove Zen, it's not for the special few. It's for the riffraff. Look at you all! Okay. If you're not riffraff, you can't come here. Okay. Okay, it's for people who are messed up. That's one thing. It feels like the heart of our practice that it includes everybody. And if it doesn't, it's not what we practice. Mr. Gutsy, I don't mean to be adamant, but it's everybody's practice. Otherwise, it isn't Zen. Adam. Okay. One thing we also pick up when we practice part of our entertainment. We see the pattern of a clench and release, of tension and openness, of suffering and end of suffering. Some dynamic, some pattern of tightness and loosening. It seems to be part of this. So not only is there openness that appears like flowers after the rain, but a pattern of kind of tension and anxiety and conflict that precedes that. So it seems to be part of the pattern. And this ties up in some sense with the koan work we do and seeing precept as koan, seeing our life as koan. Deciding to take this, deciding to make commitment, deciding to enter into this. And that, and from that, we sort of instinctively almost start to steer away from conflict and towards openness, away from suffering towards enlightenment, away from tension towards release. And at some point we find that our practice becomes a striving for, quote, enlightenment, unquote, for end of suffering, for happiness. And we turn our back on the conflict and the suffering. And it becomes a striving in our practice. So inevitably built into that is a very particular kind of tension. And the more we do it, the more we get stuck in that. It's another kind of stuckness, that ambition, that's striving for enlightenment. least for the idea of enlightenment. And then in our practice, we widen our view. We just stand back a moment. Widen our view to include the suffering as well as the enlightenment. And then that whole dynamic of trying to escape one thing in order to attain something else just softens. And now our practice includes all our difficulties and suffering and conflict. That stuff. As well as all the moments of openness and so on. So already our practice has become more embracing of our lives in its wholeness. And that's really when we begin to see life as koan, meaning when we take the widest possible view of what happens to this question, this struggle, this quest, this strive. Does it appear differently when we look at it in this way? When we look at it beyond our categories of thinking, concepts, opposites, like, dislike, good, bad, right, wrong, enlightenment, suffering, all of that stuff. When that's blown up in our arms wide open, what happens to that? That pattern of conflict and release in some measure, and there are many dimensions of it, I say is something to us all, something that we know, all of us. Just domestically, we know how it is to have tension and release, have an argument and suddenly somebody apologizes. Yeah, you're right. I have to say it all the time. Yeah, you're actually right. Okay. And then all of that ill will and one-upmanship and wanting to be right just goes, boom. Or you argue, somebody bursts into tears. Boom. That's the dynamic of koan, of practice. And when we're willing to live with all of that, the conflict as well as the release, then things get so interesting. So then we look at the koan. We look at the 10th precept as koan. How do I attain Buddha? How do I not slander Buddha? Meaning, how do I wake up? Not in general, not as a theory, in this moment. This moment. How do I listen to this talk without the truth? How do I talk? When we are awakened from this nightmare of endless thinking and judging and commenting and opinionating and pining, whatever, then we find ourselves in a land of great intimacy. A friendship, as Descartes said. Of spaciousness and clarity. And in that moment, the Dharma appears by itself. We see the interconnectedness of our of this life we live. We see, we smell, we taste the intimacy of it, of our, of what is. But each thing is not self-contained and self-sufficient unto itself, but everything is just weaving in and out. That in that there is the resolution of suffering and enlightenment, so that duality just dissolves into that moment of intimacy and interconnectedness. And that the teaching of non-self, of selflessness, is just apparent there. From one end of the room to the other. And that there, Sangha, unity, friendship, is a natural scent, aroma of this experience. And then we respond like you all did yesterday to that message from Descartes. There's no Dharma without friendship. And just stay with that for a moment. It's fun. You've got nowhere to go. Different kinds of friends. Retreat friends, retreat friendships particularly are special. Because it's people without robes, to use Lingji's phrase. Of course, we wear a robe, but real robes. We meet each other without robes, without. We don't know where we went to school. We don't know how much money we earn. We don't know who's a professor and who's a street cleaner. We don't know who's famous or celebrity. We don't know who isn't, who's been published. We don't know anything about those parts of a person's life. And yet, we feel we know each other in the silence in a very meaningful way. Sometimes people say, oh, I didn't realize he was so interesting afterwards, or such a big shot. But what we find here is the most interesting thing about everybody. There's sort of fundamental equality in this practice, whatever their status in life. That's a very unusual kind of friendship that we have. It's probably not a sort of Masonic friendship where we're going to give each other jobs. That's because most of us are struggling to stay employed. Or we retire. That's not very useful for that. But there is a kind of companionship that is remarkable, it comes in the silence. We spend a week without even looking into somebody's eyes, but we have a sense of closeness. And sometimes the friends are drinking buddies, we watch a rugby together, or we watch Usain Bolt run 100 meters, or we watch Top of the Pops, or whatever it is, it's on television. It's Big Brother, whatever. We do silly stuff like that together. That's another kind. Sometimes it's people who don't get us, people who are critical of us, or people who we find difficult. So somebody was telling me how they were waiting in line at an airport, and the woman who was handing out tickets was sullen, brief, I don't know what to call it, brusque with everybody, rude. And he got really cross and was going to sort of tell her off for not doing her job and making everyone's life difficult. And he got to the end of the line and she said, "My dog died this morning." Boom. Friendship as koan. People as koan. Not holding on to opinions about anything. Friendship beyond opinion. Very exciting. And I'm reminded of a story that I have told before, but just remember it again, friends of friendship. Friend of Margie and I was a headmaster of a township school. He died a few years back. Perfect, eminent man in his community. He lived on the top of a hill overlooking the township. And he used to come here and he'd phone up and say, "I'm coming to philosophize," he would say. And he'd come here and bring a bottle of whiskey. So he'd philosophize. And he always included both of us, which was a nice thing. So, and we had this thing of playing each other music. And so I'd drive up to his house and we'd choose whoever car had the better music system. And he just retired and he had lots of time. Come any day, he said. And we'd park overlooking the township. And on this particular occasion, I remember I was bringing him a CD, a track of a CD, David Moses, by Eva Cassidy, a song by Sting called "Fields of Gold." Beautiful song, beautiful song. And we'd roll up the windows, and we'd put in the CD, and we'd switch on the volume. And we'd sit there with this sounds, music, just overwhelming us. And looking out over the township. And amidst this bubble move of music, looking at people fighting, drunk woman falling down, children without any clothes on, their dogs fighting, people sitting on the corner without jobs. Just all this sort of poverty and distress and this beauty. And just not being able to hold it. The impossibility of all this. Just sitting there weeping. And then as the beauty continued and the poverty and suffering continued, we began to see children playing, women washing clothes in the sun. An old man sitting puffing at his pipe. Children laughing. People going off to work. All this beauty and suffering. Wonder, just appearing, trying to make conclusions and comments and opinions about it to make it manageable. And just not succeed. No Dharma without friendship. No practice without friendship. And the fruit of the Dharma is bound.